In this episode of the Smart City Podcast, I had a fantastic conversation with minimalist, writer, podcast host, blogger, speaker, and full-time traveler Colin Wright. We discussed the linkages between minimalism and smart cities and how people-scale cities make for happier places and reduce underutilized time. We also discussed a number of different technologies and dive deep into how science fiction can be used as a means to think about the possible societal impacts of some technologies. This was supposed to be a bit of a different episode, mixing it up because smart cities really does touch on so many aspects. So I hope you really enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
It's the Smart City Podcast, whoa, with smart city experts, here we go. Connecting smart technology, both big and small. Smart cities are making life better for all. Big data, emerging trends, self-driving cars and more. The Smart City Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hi Colin, how are you going?
I'm great, how are you doing?
I'm very well. I'm really excited to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
No worries. Let's just jump straight in. We'll be doing a little bit of a different interview or discussion today. I'm really keen to hear your thoughts about these different areas. I've been listening to your podcast, Let's Know Things, for a while now, and I know you've had a few topics on there related to smart cities, so I really wanted to get you on to talk about that. So let's just jump straight in. And how do you think that minimalism can fit into the smart city space?
I think just like with any other aspect of life or society, minimalism is about focusing on what's important and homing in on the most vital aspects of whatever it is that you're talking about, and then eschewing the superfluous, getting rid of the unnecessary stuff that you've accumulated for whatever reason, either because somebody else told you it was important or because of historical baggage or whatever it might be. So by homing in on those most vital functions, those things that you really, really think are important that your city needs to do or your community needs to do or your apartment building needs to be able to do, focusing on those things and then getting rid of the fluff that is there for no reason that we can quite ascertain other than it's always been there. That is minimalism essentially being applied to these spaces. And so a lot of what people are trying to do when we talk about smart cities and smart spaces and that type of forward thinking urban development, really what we're looking at is building things more intentionally as opposed to building things the way that we've always built them just because.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe for those who don't know what minimalism is, could you just give us a little bit of a spiel on minimalism and how it's fit into your life or how, yeah, the that philosophy has really shaped your life?
Yeah, well, it's really about focusing on what's important so that you then have more time, energy, and resources, including money, to spend on the important stuff. So in a lot of cases, that means getting rid of stuff that you own to clear out some of your space so that you're not so bogged down by it. But also very importantly, not buying stuff just to buy stuff. You buy stuff that you actually need. You buy less of better, whatever better happens to mean for you and your priorities. But then you apply the same to your relationships and your work and everything else. You act more intentionally. You do things on purpose as opposed to just doing things. And for me, minimalism has been a means of allowing me to build the type of lifestyle that I wanted to build. Back in 2009, I was running this branding studio out in Los Angeles that was doing really well financially, but I was totally killing myself. The entire lifestyle was just draining me. And I was 24 at the time, and I felt like I was going to die by the time I turned 30. I had 4 hours of sleep a night and stressed constantly. And it was a version of success, but it was not a version of success that aligned with what I actually wanted. I told myself that what was really important was getting out into the world and seeing things, seeing the world from different perspectives and continuing to learn beyond what I could learn in books. And that was what I kept telling myself. That's why I'm trying to earn all of this money. But my actions said otherwise. My actions said, well, actually, you know, working this stressful job all the time and earning tons of money that you're spending on stupid stuff, that's what's important. So as soon as I decided to make that changeover and started reducing what I owned and started recalibrating the work I was doing so I could run it from anywhere, so I could run it from my laptop, that was when I started to be more intentional about things. And that's when, although by changing things up, I started to make less money, I also was spending the money that I made more intelligently. And I had way more of my time to spend on stuff that I actually wanted to do. And it allowed me from that point forward to start traveling full time. Most of the last, what, 8, almost 9 years, I've been moving to a new country every 4 months. And the readers of my blog have voted on what country. And then I've gone and lived there and finally lived that lifestyle that I wanted, where I get to see a whole bunch of new stuff, meet a lot of new people, see the world from new perspectives. And I've been able to do that because I've been able to focus more, not because I'm making more money. I'm certainly not making more money than I used to make, but because I'm spending what I have more intentionally and being very, very clear with myself about what my priorities actually are.
Yeah. Awesome. Is it all it's cracked up to be? Is it everything you could ever want in your life?
Oh God. Yeah. It's so great. I almost feel like I did back in art school. For the longest time, I actually had like a really good family life. We never had a lot of money, but my parents are great. My siblings are great. I never had the drama and sadness that I felt that I needed to become an excellent artist at the time. And I feel that way about life now, where I'm like, man, if I ever really need to create something full of emotion, I'm not going to have any of the downside emotion to draw on, because it really was like the best decision I ever made to refocus in that way. Things just keep on getting better and better. And any problems that I might have in my life are of the very solvable, good problems variety.
Yeah. Awesome. I think that kind of leads on to current ways of working are obviously the mainstream kind of ways are, you know, you go to an office, you work 9 to 5 or somewhere around those hours, or much longer, but you're only putting 9 to 5 on your timesheet. And then, you know, we all get in our cars, and then fight the traffic to get back home to spend the money or the time that you have left with your family or pets or whoever or whatever. How do you think that the smart city space will be disrupted? How do you think the smart city space will disrupt this mainstream kind of way of working?
What I'm hoping will happen is we'll see a whole lot more people scale spaces as opposed to car scale spaces. So that means in a lot of cases, in a lot of cities that I've seen it utilized in, at least more mixed use spaces, so that you're not commuting 2 or 3 hours a day or even 20 or 30 minutes. Like it's just so much underutilized time that is a waste for everybody and everything involved. So if we can build spaces that allow far more types of work to be done far more efficiently and effectively, and hopefully in ways too that are more beneficial for people's health, because a lot of, at least the research that I've seen on the topic, a lot of the ways that offices are set up, from the commute to the way that people are seated and the offices are arranged and the way we prioritize sitting in a chair as opposed to prioritizing actual work being done, all of these things are detrimental to our health as well as being detrimental to actually accomplishing anything. And so if we can set up cities in such a way that alleviate a lot of those health related issues and happiness draining issues that we associate with work, more of us can do more of either work that we enjoy or bare minimum work that we don't feel terrible about, as if we're wasting 50% of our time doing stuff associated with work that's not actually productive. Because if you can do something that, even if you don't just enjoy it, even if you don't enjoy doing janitorial work or something like that, you can feel good about aspects of it. And if we set things up correctly, I feel like a lot more of the work that we actually do will be of that variety, where even if the work itself doesn't fulfill us on any deep, resonant intellectual level, we can still feel good about it, because you can see the end result. You're actually accomplishing something, and more of the work that you do is actually fulfilling that purpose. So whatever shape that might take, I think it will be a lot of different shapes, probably, ideally. But that to me seems to be the human consequence of building this type of city correctly, particularly on the way that we work and the way that we fulfill those many tasks that orbit around what we consider to be work today.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I know you spend a lot of time in different cities around the world. Were there any that really stood out to you as being, okay, this works?
Some more than others, but at the same time, as I say that, I also recognize that I did not work at an office in these cities. So what I was seeing was my lifestyle and people who I happened to come into contact with during my lifestyle. So I write books for a living. I make a podcast. So what I do, I can do from anywhere. That makes my perspective on this a little bit suspect. But societally, at least outside of that working environment and the way that people seem to behave and the pace that people seem to strike out at, as a consequence of that, Reykjavik in Iceland, Amsterdam in the Netherlands, places that have dense downtowns, but are not, that don't have a lot of the same downsides as a dense downtown like New York City or something like that. It's just a different way of structuring a society. And typically it's in places that were built before the car, or that were built the modern iteration without the car as the central focus. That's why I typically say human scale or car scale. You can totally tell when a city is built for somebody walking out their front door and being able to walk or take mass transportation to a place, as opposed to a place where everything was built for the car in mind. So you can walk out your front door, but you won't get very far beyond the blocks surrounding your home or your apartment building. Where I'm living right now in Memphis, Tennessee, for instance, there's little neighborhoods and you can kind of get places, but most of them are not mixed use. So there's not going to be a grocery store or a post office or things that you might want to walk to. You can walk to other residential buildings, but then to get to another neighborhood, there's usually a highway or something in the way. So it's built with the car first. You have to get into a car to go do just about anything. And that prioritization then affects the pace, and it affects the way that people interact with each other. You're not going to accidentally run into somebody while walking to the store. You're in your car, they're in their car. So all the spaces in between are like this weird gray zone that nobody's responsible for or taking care of. And the cities that I tend to enjoy and the cities where people seem to be happiest, whether or not this translates into their office experience, I can't say for sure. But when I see people out and about, at least, people tend to be most chilled out and happy and enjoying the space and respecting the space in a lot of ways too, in those types of environments, in the people first environments.
Yeah, cool. What do you think? Well, I mean, there's lots of social impacts. My question is basically about the social impacts of technology. Obviously there's so many different angles you can take to this, but maybe we can talk a little bit about autonomous vehicles, because I know that's one of the podcasts that I listen to of yours. Do you want to go through a little bit of your research on that and well, electric and autonomous vehicles, about the social impacts and the many different alternate futures that can kind of occur based on this technology?
Yeah, God, it's such a big, constantly evolving space. Fortunately, that's good, I think, because I don't know which direction we're going to go. We need a lot of different players in this space with different opinions about it, I think. But the most obvious, and to me, the most immediate direction that this goes, is that we end up with a proportion, a certain percentage of all the cars on the road that are autonomous and hopefully also electric. Having those two collections of technologies together tends to optimize the effects of both. If you have an electric car, then you are using, hopefully, depending on where you get your electricity, but it enables you at least to prioritize certain types of cleaner electricity and electricity distribution and smart grid effects. And then with autonomous cars, you get something of the same, actually, because you have cars that are not necessarily ever needing to be parked, for instance. They can constantly be optimized to be going around and Ubering or Lyfting or going around and picking up people as they're needed, as opposed to having this very expensive, very resource intensive asset that most people use like 2% of the time. You've got the car parked most of the time that you own it, and it's sitting there both taking up real estate and utilizing these resources for a non-optimized purpose. So if you're able to get both of these collections of technologies together, electric autonomous cars. You optimize for electricity and other resource usage, but also the space that's utilized for these cars, these vehicles. And that's amazing because if you look around cities, a whole lot of real estate, a whole lot of resources are dedicated to just storing these big resource sucks of a technology. They're just sitting there all the time. And it can ruin really great downtown areas, and it can ruin really great neighborhoods because you need to be able to park in a way to get there. But at the same time, as soon as you install this massive parking garage that takes up space that could be used for absolutely anything else, something much better for actual functioning societies, as opposed to just spaces meant to house these chunks of resources. So that to me is like the base level next step. Hopefully we get to a point where we can utilize that much more efficiently and effectively. Now, from there, you get to some really interesting, seemingly quite bizarre science fiction scenarios where, because these are spaces that would conceivably not need drivers, you wouldn't need to sit at a driving, at a steering wheel. You could just sit down in this space, and that space could be absolutely anything. So that brings to light the option that instead of just having an Uber, a car on demand to autonomously take you wherever you want to go as efficiently as possible, you could have a co-working space car. You could have a gym car. You could have a movie theater car, and you could summon each of these from different companies, or summon a particular type of car from Uber or whatever other company. And you could get a whole lot done just in these cars. And from there, extrapolating to the nth degree, at a certain point, you can't help but wonder, well, if we're doing all of these things in these rooms, essentially, these gyms, these theaters, these offices that are moving around, why do we even need stable, non-moving, non-autonomous structures to begin with? Particularly if these cars, these autonomous rooms that we want to be in on wheels that can take us wherever, especially if they're so resource non-intensive as they would hopefully be at this point. So you can go in a lot of crazy directions. You could look at it through the lens of the current paradigm where cars are things that get us from building to building, place to place, and just say, well, it would be that, but much more efficient on multiple levels. Or you could say the very structure of society would change, the very structure of what it means to be in a building, in a domicile, in a room, at a gym would change, and therefore society would restructure in a lot of very interesting, strange, modular ways that could change what it means to live within a city.
Yeah, awesome. That's really interesting to think about. Like, you could just live in an autonomous vehicle, I suppose.
Yeah, well. Or just continue to summon them whenever you need them. So yeah. We could be much more, we could focus much more on those human-shaped spaces, go out and do things and be places and be present with other people. And then whenever you need it, whatever type of room or resource you happen to need, whatever type of internal space you need to rent, you maybe just have an account. You pay $1,000 a month and you get unlimited rides, but those rides happen. Some of them have a bed in it. Some of them have a couch. Whatever you need in the moment, you've got it, and it will take you between these human populated, human shaped spaces. Again, it's a little bit sci-fi and hard to imagine because it takes us out of our current paradigm where there are locations. Locations are important. You live in a particular city, in a particular neighborhood, and getting from place to place is more a necessity because of work and because of the way that we organize people within societies, like for tax purposes and government purposes. But all of that conceivably could change if something more modular and a little bit messier by today's standards were to become effective and convenient enough to the point and desirable enough, I guess, that people would actually want to live that way.
Yeah, definitely. One of the technologies I'm really interested in is like tracking full life cycle of products. And so, you know, when you buy a shirt, you'll be able to track back to go, okay, that's where it was made. This is who made it. This is how long it stayed there, those type of things, the environments that it was in or the environments that people were in that were making this. Do you have any thoughts on that and how it can really change the way we think about compulsive consumption?
Yeah, this is actually a space that I really believe that a lot of what we're doing with tracking, like fitness trackers and RFID tags and everything that we do with tracking today, they tend to be half measures. And in a lot of cases, they're applied to places where they're not as effective as they could be. Whereas to me, particularly the products, some products more than others, like products that use rare earth metals and things of that nature, the more we can track that kind of thing, the more we can make people aware or communicate better the true cost of certain things. And like, I'm not anti stuff. I just think that if we can be more aware of what goes into the stuff that we buy, if we can understand how it's being manufactured, who's doing the manufacturing, what actual materials and processes are involved, what the actual water cost might be of some of these products, particularly in regions that are prone to drought, that would help us make far better decisions. I mean, it could be that people don't care. There have been instances, particularly within the U.S., where some states have mandated that you have to put the caloric information on foods, even at fast food restaurants. And so people suddenly go into McDonald's and they realize, oh my God, that thing I've been eating for lunch every day is like 30,000 calories. And it didn't change their habits at all. It gave them a bit of information, and then they didn't feel they had any reason to act on it, because I think most people knew already, maybe not the specifics, but they knew that what they were doing was not particularly healthy. So it could be something like that. But I think, especially now, a lot of people, particularly younger people, but people of all ages, because of the information available via the internet, are starting to take this type of thing into consideration more, and making it a point to invest more, even if it costs a dollar or two more for whatever product they're buying, if they consider it to be an ethical production cycle. And providing that information now more than any other time in history might actually give people that relevant information that they can then use when they're voting with their dollars. That may or may not actually be the practical reality of it, but I absolutely think that having more data in those regards, in terms of every step of the process, including the shipping and the packaging and everything else, having more of that data, quantifying it correctly, and then communicating it well, that could potentially go a long way toward, on one hand, encouraging companies to be a little bit more intentional about that stuff, but on the other hand, also encouraging people to be more aware of this kind of thing and maybe consuming more intentionally.
Yeah, definitely. I know you did one episode on Bitcoin. Did you do a lot of research into blockchain?
I did. Yeah, it's an interesting space, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I jumped on the bandwagon and bought some crypto. Few months ago now, and it's I sold my principal luckily because it's kind of plummeted, but my friends at work tell me that it'll go back up again, so I don't need to worry. But I'm more interested in the blockchain, you know, using for that tracking. Did you come across any companies or examples of where they're using it already to track that kind of life cycle of a product?
I have not. It wouldn't surprise me if somebody's trying to do that. I haven't seen anything like that yet. I'm cautiously optimistic about this technology. I think it's really cool. I haven't bought any crypto. I'm kind of sitting that gold rush out. That may be a mistake, but it may also be the smart move if indeed this round, the current iteration of cryptocurrency to me kind of seems like the stepping stone to whatever it's going to become. And I kind of feel that way about blockchain in general as well, where it's a very cool technology, but it seems to me that if it was going to become a fundamental and better technology for one of these many things that it could do, that someone at this point would have managed to make that work. And I've seen a lot of somewhat gimmicky applications of it thus far. And it's become a truism that on the stock market, you can increase your valuation threefold overnight if you just change your name to blockchain something something. There was the Long Island Iced Tea Company that changed their name to Long Blockchain, I think, and they gained like 1700% overnight, something crazy like that. A lot of silly things like that. I don't think in all cases that's true. And I think a lot of the technology in that space is very cool and very innovative and has a lot of potential. But from what I've seen, and particularly for that type of use case, I kind of get the impression it needs something else. There's some ingredient missing. And it may be, which would upset many people, that ingredient that's missing is government oversight. It may be that ingredient is some new piece of technology, better processing power, or even just a better way of communicating what this technology does so people understand what the blockchain actually means and why it might be valuable. There's a lot of different things that it could be. My sense is that it's not there yet, but I am totally hopeful that I will be proved wrong on that. It would be really cool to see some type of application for the current iteration so that then from there, future iterations will be a step further than they would otherwise.
Yeah, cool. Well, I'll be interviewing either the CEO or someone in her team of Everledger, and I'll probably butcher what it actually does, but they use the blockchain for diamonds, so the insurance of diamonds.
Nice.
So I'm hoping that I'll learn a lot from that because, again, I'm optimistically keen about it, but I'm not a coder and I can't quite get my head around how it all kind of works or will, you know, come to work in the mainstream environment, but I can definitely see the potential for it. So I'm similar to you. And I think at the moment there's a lot of hype. I mean, it's similar with smart cities. There's a lot of hype around that, you know, everything's going to be connected to everything and, you know, that'll make the best city or whatever, like lots of hype, lots of people, buzzwords and that kind of thing. But actually, it's the fundamental stuff that's really important. We need to cut through that hype and talk about, you know, fundamental changes and societal changes and that kind of thing. And that's the stuff that's really important, beyond the shiny toys, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And my policy for anything like this is to get excited, geek out, like allow yourself to do the research and get excited about the potential, but then, you know, self-reflect. And the more excited you are about it means that you should require more proof. You should be all the more skeptical about it because you will be seeing things through the lens of that enthusiasm and that doesn't give it a fair shake. You should absolutely be very skeptical and require all the more proof if you think a particular technology or possible way of setting up a city happens to be really neat.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I agree. What do you think the emerging trends are that people aren't talking about at the moment?
Ooh, within smart cities?
Within smart cities. Or within technology, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, what's really nice about living today is that with almost everything, someone is talking about it. Even if it's not like one of the mainstream presses, if it's not in the New York Times or something, that doesn't mean that somebody isn't talking about it. I would be very interested, and I am very interested, to see what happens with 3D manufacturing. And that may not be what we actually end up calling it. You know, you could call it additive or subtractive manufacturing. There's different types of 3D printing where you carve away from material or you add to material layer by layer. That was kind of like virtual reality in a way where it had kind of a moment and everybody was like, oh, this is the future. Put 3D printing inside of anything and it makes their stock price go up. And then it kind of floundered for some reason. And part of it was that they failed, companies like MakerBot in particular, failed to come up with a rationale, a reason why most consumers should buy a $500 printer that could make toys for their home. That to me is not the most compelling use case for this type of technology. I personally think like science fiction novels are a great resource for imagining how the world might be with different technologies above and beyond. Sometimes they take great liberties with how the technologies work, but they are an amazing resource if you want to imagine the social ramifications and the ramifications on relationships and the economy and politics and everything else, because the people who write these stories are really great at describing that aspect of what happens when new technologies are introduced and adopted. And there's a book by Neal Stephenson, I think it's called Diamond Age, where there's a lot going on in this book. All of his books are like 1,000 pages and the first third is just world building. So it takes a second to get into it. But in this book, something really compelling about it that isn't even really a vital part of the storyline. It's a world in which they've created these mass recycling and 3D printing technologies, so that essentially everything up to a point is free. You can, there's homeless populations living in these cities that sit by these community 3D printers, and any person who wants it can push a button and get a set of clothing or get a sleeping bag or get basic foodstuffs. And it's all free because turning matter into other types of matter, converting raw recycled matter into a sandwich or into clothing, that costs the city essentially nothing. It takes a little bit of power and that's it. And otherwise, we've got these massive systems where anytime something is discarded, it is reduced back down to its fundamental components, just down to this raw matter that can then be used to convert into anything else. And to me, that there's a lot of potential for that. Maybe not converting down to that level of constituent parts, but being able to recycle electronics in particular. Certain companies like Apple are already doing this for the rare earth minerals that are in some of their devices. They encourage you to recycle your phone or allow you to trade it in for credit. Because if they can give you $150 for an iPhone that's a few generations old, they can take the chips out of that and get that much money back essentially in recycling those chips for these materials that are otherwise very expensive. I think there's a lot of opportunity for that type of technology. And it's just not something that unfortunately is very sexy. It's not the type of thing that's going to allow you to print your own rocket booster or something in your backyard. It's not going to allow you to make your own video game. It's something that would be really valuable though on a social level and an infrastructural level, and particularly in places where it's very expensive or difficult to ship things. And if we can reduce some of the shipping requirements, specifically for very small or very niche parts that we would otherwise have to ship and spend a great deal of fuel and packaging and stuff to deliver things, that to me seems like a very valuable place to put some of our effort. And little steps are being taken here and there, but it's not something, unfortunately, that's being utilized on any large scale quite yet.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I wanted to hear when I talk about emerging trends people aren't talking about, because it's definitely something that would be highly beneficial. Something quite simple, you know, that we could do now with a bit more push behind it. You know, it could be quite scalable. And I agree, it's not sexy, but it's really kind of fundamental, one of those fundamental things when you cut through the hype, you know, those fundamental things that we kind of need in our society. So yeah, no, awesome. So I really just have one last question. Well, actually I have two. I think when you spoke about sci-fi, I've been watching the series Black Mirror. I don't know if you watched that.
Oh yeah, that's a great series.
Oh, it's, I mean, the first episode is insane. So push through that and get to the next one.
The pig one?
Yeah, the pig one. Yeah. But I found it really interesting from a smart city space. Like, shit, if that's what people are watching and that's what they think a smart city is, then, you know, we're all doomed basically. But it really showed the societal impacts really well. And so then it makes me want to be in this space more. So then we have people that are not corrupt, or, you know, the people that can understand those things and talk about and make decisions that hopefully won't lead to some of those outcomes. So, yeah, I find it really fascinating. I'm glad to hear that you've watched it as well.
It's so good. I love classic sci-fi. I've always been a big sci-fi reader, but I particularly love what's happening now with shows like Black Mirror, but also movies and a lot of very popularized science fiction books recently. One of Stevenson's books, Seven Eves, was really popular when it came out, which was great to see. But basically anything that we can do to show both the pros and the cons. So dystopias are very valuable. The Black Mirror type of presentation, showing in some cases very cool stuff. I very distinctly remember watching many episodes of Black Mirror and thinking partway through, like, oh my God, that's so cool, I want that. And then by the end, I'm like, oh wait, no, we can't possibly do that. How horrible. And being able to show that dichotomy of each of these technologies is a really valuable means of prognosticating. It's a really excellent way of telling that story to people who otherwise don't necessarily know why they should care, and being able to show the human impact and the way society might change and how your concerns might change and how your day-to-day might change for better and for worse with each of these technologies is great. Because we don't want to build a dystopian society. We don't want to accidentally build a tyrant-led panopticon. But a lot of the things that we take for granted, a lot of social media and things like that we have today, they are the building blocks of a dictatorship-led panopticon. Like, all of the pieces are in place, and it's being used by some countries in that way to greater and lesser degrees already. And recognizing that and throwing it in people's faces with an amplified version of that, like a caricaturized version of what these technologies are actually doing, to me is a super valuable way of having these types of discussions.
Yeah, definitely. The one that sticks out in my head the most is the one where you have the rating beside your head, and then you rate, you know, oh yeah, great 5-star conversation with Colin. Yep.
Cool. Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah. The ranking system one.
Yeah. That was just, I really enjoyed, I have to go and watch it again, I think, because I was just like, it was like depressing, but enjoyable at the same time, because I was like, oh, what's going to happen, you know? And then it's really, that's how some people do live their lives at the moment. It's just that, you know, the next step is that everyone else can see, you know, how many rating, oh, well, not everyone else can see, I suppose, if they go into Instagram or something like that. But it's really, really fascinating.
Yeah, I've had that conversation with probably 3 or 4 people just in the last couple of weeks, where people told me that they dropped off social media entirely because they realized that it was affecting them more than they thought it was. And they were really getting depressed if they didn't get above a certain number of likes on a photo that they would post, even though they knew intellectually it didn't matter. It was making them feel bad and really affecting the rest of their life, the rest of their day. So they decided to cut it out entirely because they realized, wow, you know, that type of social feedback, it feels like it means something that it actually doesn't, because of the way that we are biologically built and the way that we tend to organize. These technologies are utilizing that in ways that are sometimes positive, but can sometimes be very negative as well.
Yeah, definitely. With like my Facebook, I used to spend a lot of time like procrastinating when I was at uni, just like scrolling through crap, you know. Anyway, I was just like, oh, why would someone post that? And then I thought, well, Zoe, you're bloody looking at it and reading it, and what does that make you? And so I ended up unfollowing so many people. And so on my Facebook, I really only have you know, a few key friends that post normal stuff, and then like the articles or you know, science or whatever articles or whatever that I want to read. And I found that has really, really helped me use it as a tool rather than, you know, sucking my time, because there's not a lot on my newsfeed to start with, but then the stuff that's on there I'm actually interested in. So I found that was really, really good way to do it.
Yeah, I do something similar. I am constantly checking in to assess what I'm using it for, and then checking to see if it's still serving that purpose. And the baseline that I've landed at is basically following very few people, only the people who I actually care what they have to say on a day-to-day basis. And then on things like Twitter, only following people who are resources for different industries that I want to follow, people who are journalists and experts on different fields. So yeah, again, it's a tool as opposed to a kind of social collar that you have to wear.
Yeah, definitely. Awesome. Well, it's just been so great to talk to you. I just have one last question, which is, how can people connect with you?
Well, they can find my author website at colin.io. My blog is exilelifestyle.com. My podcast is Let's Note Things. And on most social media, the ones I'm still using, I am at Colin is my name.
Awesome. I'll put all that in the show notes, and I'll put some of the stuff we discussed in the show notes as well. Thanks so much for saying yes to coming on to the Smart City podcast.
My pleasure.
It's been amazing.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's the Smart City Podcast. Whoa.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart City Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes can be found at thesmartcitypodcast.com. If you have any questions or comments for me or any of my guests, connect with me via email, zoe@thesmartcitypodcast.com, or via the socials. I'm on Twitter and Facebook at Smart City Pod. As always, I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
Smart City Podcast is what you're looking for.